blackbird, red-winged blackbird, down my road. Thought I heard a red-winged blackbird, down my road. He'll be there beside the river when winter finally breaks its bones. He'll be king among the rushes, he'll be master of his home. Thought I heard a red-winged blackbird, down my road. Thought I heard a red-winged blackbird, down my road. Safe as Moses in the rushes, builds his home on the river wide. Every time I hear him singing, makes me feel like spring inside. Thought I heard a red-winged blackbird, down my road. Thought I heard a red-winged blackbird, down my road. Red-winged blackbird, down my road. Thought I heard a red-winged blackbird, down my road. Thought I heard a red-winged blackbird, down my road. Thought I heard a red-winged blackbird, down my road.
Well, on this wintry looking day outside the window of the studio from high atop Magic Mountain as the snow comes down, a sign of spring, not yet, but red-winged blackbirds. And I chose that piece because I read an article. I get a weekly paper from Midcoast, Maine. It's called The Island Advantages, and they have a I don't know. He's written a lot of books. Maybe he is a certified ornithologist. His name is Pete Dunn. And his column this week in The Island Advantages, published in Stonington Deer Isle, Turling goes the red-winged blackbird, Turling. And Pete writes that he wrote this a couple of weeks ago. The vernal milestone that marks the midpoint between the first days of winter and spring, of course, is what we call Groundhog Day. We winter-weary humans thirst for natural markers that mark the advance towards spring. For my money, the first day of spring arrives the day male red-winged blackbirds unfurl their crimson epaulets, the banners of spring. I'm going to forward this along to Henry, and we'll probably post it on our notes if you want to read a little bit more about red-winged blackbirds. That performance that you just heard is David Francie, a Canadian singer-songwriter, well-regarded. He's performed down this way a couple of times over the years. But before we get Henry on the air, and we've got a pretty busy show and a very interesting guest today, we do want to acknowledge the White River Land Collaborative, Wit and Grit Solar Fest, and more about them in the course of the coming weeks. First Branch Coffee Company, the Upper Pass Beer Company, Daniel Leibowitz, Royal Trail Works, Solaflect, and Bale. Those are the underwriters that keep us going. There is more information about hours and websites and directions and services provided by all those generous underwriters. Well, now I think I'll go ahead and turn up your mic, Henry. You're with us now. Good morning.
Yes, I like that rendition of red-winged blackbird. A very good one.
Couldn't agree more. So, like I said, I think there's a way I can send this article. Apparently, I'm allowed to get one free online article, so I've used up my one. I do have the hard copy at home, but I'll send that to you after the show. So what's up today?
Great. I'll put it in.
All right.
Yeah. So we have, as a guest, we're going to give him as much time as possible. We have David Johnson of New Mexico State University, who with his wife, Hui Chen Su, created a way of homebrewing a fungal-rich inoculant. And David's gone on to do many field trials under various conditions, creating statistically significant productivity report for adopting and using this inoculant. And it's pretty remarkable. It has the, if it were to be well adopted across the world, his numbers are if only 20% of the farming land in the world, the arable land, the land that's open and ready to be used for farming, were to be treated in this way, it would pull down all the carbon that we're currently emitting by our burning of fossil fuels. So it would go a long ways towards reversing climate change.
Yeah, it would.
We will get into how that can apply to us and what we can do to push and get some adoption it's really enhancing the ecosystem with complexity. And complexity always is more resilient. And this works in spades.
Certainly does. So, all right, we'll be... Go ahead.
Yeah, so that'll be around quarter after, so not coming up soon. And I tuned into Bernie Sanders' call-a-thon last night with Senator Welch and our representative Becca Ballant, who, and she gave a great piece of advice in her introductory remarks. He said, in this chaotic time of chaos, find something you have a passion about and do your best to move that forward and take action on it.
Yeah.
And because it is sort of scattershot coming at you from all directions, and it tends to immobilize me. I don't know about the rest of you.
Well, you were definitely taking in a whole lot more data and going to Zoom meetings and really involved than I am. I do quite a bit of reading and I do follow things, but I do think I was tuned in. Both of us were tuned into that sort of town meeting by way of phone and by way of Zoom, and I thought her comments were very strong. And doing things locally, as of course all of us talk about, and I'm very fortunate that two of my passions actually come together right now at 11 o'clock on Thursdays. An ardent environmentalist for a very long time and an ardent radiophile for a really long time. So that's my little contribution. Hopefully I can make some more. But yeah, interesting talk like that and very good. Hey, Henry, I'm going to ask you one thing, but let's talk a little bit more. But once we get Bird Note going, I don't know if you're hearing a crackling audio on your end of things, but I am hearing it with you. We might want to have you call in again during Bird Note. So
that, I'll do that.
Okay.
I'll do that. No, I'm not hearing it.
But, yeah, it's not.
But
it's,
if you're hearing it, probably the listeners are hearing it.
I think it, so they are. It's not knocking us off, so if it turns out that it doesn't go away. But maybe we should go to Bird Note now and get reconnected by phone. And today's Bird Note, so I'm going to bring you down in the mix, Henry, and take you out of the system here briefly. In fact, if I do that. Yep, sorry. Goodbye, Henry. This is for Bird Note, and we do this every week. He's calling back immediately. Wow, that is quick. So we'll go ahead and activate him again, and he should be in the system. So here is Bird Note, and this one is called The Pecking Order. It's best to be the alpha bird. Let me make sure I'm on the right page. I am. Let her go.
This is Bird Note. If you like drama, watch the juncos at your bird feeder. These small brown birds will get quite feisty around food. You'll see one bird come in to grab a bite, then another darts over and pushes the first bird off, or two birds may have a little tiff with their tails flared out. What's going on here? Birds in flocks almost invariably develop a literal pecking order, or, as scientists call it, a dominance hierarchy. The term comes from studies of chickens, which found that there was an alpha chicken that could peck any other chicken in the flock. A beta chicken could peck all others except the alpha, and so on. Think of the poor omega chicken all the way at the bottom. With juncos, we know that males are dominant to females and adults are dominant to young birds. So, next time you see a group of birds, pay close attention to the dynamics among them. Who's the alpha? And who's the beta? Can you spot the omega? Do the birds flock together or work apart? You can learn about all kinds of birds when you come to our website, birdnote.org. I'm Mary McCann.
Well, thank you very much for that, Mary. And Henry, I think you're reconnected here. How are you sounding now?
Yeah, I don't know. How am I sounding?
That sounds pretty clean.
Did you crackle?
And the snap and the pop went away as well. So, no,
boy,
you're good to go, and you're not even
a bad original phone line.
Nope.
So that's a project to do. We have slate-colored juncos, or also called black-eyed juncos, here in Burlington around our feeder. And they're very active, and a lot of them bustling back and forth at the same time. But that'll take some actual looking to figure out which ones are the alpha. And it's definitely ones that get first choice. And that's a little bit true of a lot of the birds at the feeder. It's not just the juncos, but and then there are groups of birds like the goldfinches. When they arrive, everyone else goes away. Or when the blue jay arrives, everyone else goes away. So there's that kind of thing between breeds as well.
Yeah, and I've noticed
so
that.
So there's a project.
Definitely
them birds
a project. Yeah, when the nuthatch appears, we've got sort of a double-decker feeder. And when the nuthatch appears from a tree, not from the bush, the chickadees stop coming to that feeder. They go to the lower feeder, to the ground. And as soon as the nuthatch flies away, they're fine with coming to the upper feeder. With other breeds of birds that come, the chickadees don't seem to be that nervous about them, and they will share the feeder. So I think that could be an example of some sort of hierarchical between between the birds.
Them nuthatches have a really sharp bill.
Yeah. All right, I'll be careful when I see that nuthatch. Just to remind folks, you are listening to Green Zine here on Royalton Community Radio. It's 13 minutes past the hour of 11 o'clock, and I know you were going to check in with our guest. Henry, should I let you do that, and I'll take care of a story while you're off the air. Very good.
Great.
Yep. All right, well, we do get the Herald here on Thursdays, and that is the White River Valley Herald, and just to acknowledge them as an in-kind media underwriter of this radio station, we get an ad in the paper, and then we mention that they are supporting this radio station, and there's so much great local information in here, including some environmentally related and natural world related talks coming up, and one of them is coming up this very Sunday, Caring for Vermont's Forest, a conversation about sustainable forestry will be happening this Sunday, and that's March 2nd at 2 p.m. at the Tunbridge Public Library. And a local forester is going to be there, Kate Forer of Tunbridge. She is the executive, well, I shouldn't say she's a forester. I think maybe her husband is. Kate Forer of Tunbridge, she is the executive director of the Vermont Woodlands Association. They are a nonprofit dedicated to promoting healthy forests through responsible stewardship. Kate has more than two decades of experience in forestry outreach and community engagement. Forer is passionate about fostering a deeper connection between people and the land. As an outreach specialist with UVM Extension, she collaborated with communities to help them understand the ecological, economic, and social values of the state's forest. She says her approach emphasizes conservation through stewardship and balancing the diverse needs of wildlife habitat, timber production, recreation, and conservation while supporting Vermont's growing community of woodland stewards and nurturing the next generation. I've been to some of these talks before on many different subjects, and I think what I enjoy most about them is not only the presentation by an expert on a certain subject, and there'll be a talk about bats the following Friday, and we'll give you more information on that as we get closer, but is the Q&A that happens from the audience. a lot of them may have some woodlands and forests on their private property, and having that give and take between people that live locally and care deeply about a subject and the expert that is speaking to them in front of the library. So you might want to put that on your calendar. I think the weather's okay on Sunday. You can make it on out there. Let's see if Henry's been able to make that connection out to our guest in New Mexico. Henry, are you back with us? Should we give him a countdown? You know what I'll do? I'm going to bring him back down. This is a piece of music we're going to play more towards the end of the show. Actually, no, I'll wait on that one. We're always prepared here, at least we try to be. Let's play a little bit of this waltz while we're waiting for Henry. This is Chris Thiele along with Edgar Meyer. You're listening to Green Zine here at Free Vermont Radio. Just checking in to see if Henry, have you rejoined us there? So I'll take this moment to get to a story that I definitely want to get out there for folks that may be in the legal world and in the media world specifically. We broadcast, as we like to say, from high atop Magic Mountain here in South Royalton on the campus of the Vermont Law and Graduate School. And that institution is seeking, this has just been announced, seeking applicants for their environmental fellowships, which are happening this morning. I hear Amtrak coming. We have a little story on them that we might squeeze in before the end of the hour. This year, the center is accepting 3 journalists focused on environmental law and policy and 2 focused on animal law and policy. The fellowships are open to full-time journalists who cover environmental issues such as natural resources, energy, legal affairs, public health, animal law, and policy, and other environmental-related subjects. Selected 2025 media fellows have access to distinguished faculty and visiting policy leaders. They can meet for on- or off-the-record conversations with these experts to develop new insights, meet new sources, and gain renewed enthusiasm for covering the critical issues in climate change, animal law, energy, and other areas. I have a feeling they're going to be also asked to participate in the Hot Topics in Environmental Law series that Courtney Collins pulls together each summer. Looking forward to catching up with Courtney about that. All this information can be found by going to the application deadlines pretty soon, actually, Sunday, March 16th. If you know a journalist who has a specialization in any of those areas of environmental law, have them go to this website, vermontlaw.edu. And look for those media fellowships. I'll bet you that Henry's with us now. Henry, are you back on the line?
I am, and I not only have David Johnson, but I have his wife, Wei Chin, who together put together a way of developing a fungal-rich compost, really, that they then have experimented with using on crops and increasing the fungal component in the soil. And so it's pretty exciting results, in my opinion. It's as ground-shaking as anything that has gone on in the agricultural sector. Which is, you know, I think a big statement. Okay, so welcome to Green Zine, David and Wei Chin.
Thank you, Henry. We're glad to be here. happy to be here.
Yes. So, so your work with increasing the fungal component and the biodiversity in that soil complex, it's not all just a fungal thing, but tell us a little bit about how this impacts food production and quality, and probably from a sales point of view, more importantly, the profitability of a farm, and from my perspective, the improvement in the climate by drawing down that carbon into the soil to make the soil work better as a growing medium.
Well, I guess the first part is fungi are part of a system, and they're about the first one to go with our conventional agriculture practices, application of fertilizers, insecticides, fungicides, the plowing. All of these issues pretty much degrade your fungal component in your soil. And we're seeing in agriculture, there's not a high population of fungi, but there's a very big population of bacteria. It's an imbalance in the system. Fungi are critical. I think Paul Stamets said they're the neural network of our soils. They're the brains, so to speak. They're the maestros. They conduct the symphony in the soil in a way that they're interacting between plants and other organisms in the soil. They very much depend on carbon for their energy supplies to sort of break down the plant material. And in the process, they also break down the plant material to where your bacteria can start to degrade it. And you start to get this cycling of nutrients. And all of this depends on that carbon flow into the soil. It's the energy in the system. And in agriculture, our bare fallows, again, application of herbicides and fertilizers, they have decreased the ability of these systems to capture that carbon and funnel it through a microbial community. Go ahead.
So that carbon that is so important, that's really all coming from green plants, from photosynthesis taking place. Am I right?
Exactly. All of them depend on each other, but all of it comes down to, okay, how much carbon can that plant capture to input into that system so it can become a healthy system?
I have a quick question, David. Is there sort of a chronological timeline that you've been studying as far as that, the rate of degradation, let's say if we go back to, the beginning of the Industrial Revolution or even further back? I mean, is this something that's really picking up, is accelerating as far as that degradation going?
Oh, well, you mean as far as what we're doing in our soils, how we've increase the degradation rate of carbon?
Yeah, in other words, if we went back 200 years ago, I would imagine it's a totally different situation than what you're encountering now.
Yeah. We're farming soils that the bison helped create. They have 20-foot deep carbon soil profiles, and we farm that out.
Yeah.
So, yeah, definitely, we've degraded these soils.
And I would add that with a system how it was before, without all this chemical disturbance and the all the mechanical power of disturbance to the soil and the system, that back then things could regenerate and it keeps that equilibrium much better. But then as now, how we sort of speak of the carbon is like our saving account, that we not just taking it out, but we accelerating the speed of taking all the carbon out without restoring, without allowing the system to replenish, to regenerate, as if that you just never work, you just never put any more back in there, not even a slower rate of regenerate, but it just you're just taking it out more and more. So I often wanted to emphasize the fact that it's a system. We need to look at it. And as we talk about our compost bioreactor, that with the inoculant from it, with the biological that we put in there, that's because our soil has been so degraded that we lose the life in the soil to help the plants and everything to regenerate.
I see.
As we've taken that carbon out, well, we've taken the nitrogen out of the soil as well because it's very closely associated. So, you know, we've lost on both ends, both carbon and nitrogen.
And also when you lose that organic matter in the soil, which is holds carbon and nitrogen, or is a piece of that, as you lose that, you also lose the soil's ability to hold water. And hence we're now paying farmers from government programs for having extreme drought and extreme flood in the same year. And some of that's because storms are bigger, but a lot of it is because the soils aren't holding water anymore.
Yeah, the infiltration part is very, very critical. And again, that depends on the amount of carbon in your soil. It depends on the activity of the earthworms in your soil for opening it up to infiltrate the water in. And if you have a compacted soil, a lot of the water just runs off. In the research we did on some rangeland studies, you'd lose a third to half your water just from flowing off the surface and never going into the soil at all. So it's, you get many benefits to bringing back the carbon, bringing back all the system, all the organisms that open it up for that infiltration of water.
And I would add about this water infiltration and absorption benefit to the plants. What we noticed is in one of the projects that we're working on, a recent project, the soil was so compacted, so poor, overworked, pulverized. So whenever you have a spot that is a lower spot, you have a stagnant water, it will stay there forever. And nothing will even grow, not even the weeds will grow there. Because it basically just, the soil becomes anaerobic and also that it just kind of drowns all the plants. However, what we noticed recently on one of our test plots on our own property, we had a couple of a water line. The ends came undone. And it kind of flooded one area of Davis cover crop. We noticed that the rest of the plot was regular growth, but then there was this one place, it was almost like a wetland. You could see water there right after the irrigation. However, that water did not stay on the surface. It infiltrated eventually, you know, pretty correctly, and the vegetation, they were able to capitalize on the water, excessive water. And that was a very exciting accidental found because, or observation, because that you would think that excessive water would drown all the vegetation, but yet, because the infiltration rate of the plot of land, that soil, able to take in the water, able to absorb it, and allow the vegetation to utilize it.
And the cover crops are instrumental in that as well, to open the soil up. So having something growing, something photosynthesizing all year round is key to this the success of this approach.
Yes, I have a friend, Dee Dee Pursehouse, here in Vermont, who has a website, the Soil Carbon Sponge. And she says good soil are like bed springs. They have lots and lots of air in them, a place for the water to infiltrate.
And yep, that, yep, we know Dee Dee.
Yeah, she's okay. Pretty awesome.
I'm going to tell her you said that.
Okay. You can quote us on that.
I definitely will do that.
So Yes. So we get those bed springs by having green growing plants as many days of the year as possible. And you're in a dry climate there where you originally started your work in New Mexico, and then you've taken that work to other places in the world to see it under other conditions. And I think that when you have a especially limited growing conditions, that you learn a lot from doing experiments, so that you've probably found things out from working under difficult conditions that wouldn't be noticed from us Vermont farmers when we have rainfall aplenty all year long.
Yeah, and when we do get a project, it seems like the land we get is not the best. They always give us their worst. So it's worked out good that way, though, because, you know, they can see the changes then.
Yeah. So just to review kind of what's good for the soil and what isn't. So we've talked about building in more complexity in the soil and raising the fungal component, and you've mentioned it, but just to re-enumerate the things that tend to destroy soil, I think a lot of organic farmers in Vermont are still doing a lot of practices that are destructive to their soil.
Well, the first thing would be to view the soil as a living organism. That's the most important part, because in our farming system today, it's mainly considered just a sponge or a vehicle to hold the plant up. But all the activity that goes on in the soil, when you bring back that full microbial system, it's how this planet evolved. We would not be here had it not been for the bacteria and the fungi and all the microorganisms. And it's their associations with plants that have enabled the plants to be so successful on this planet. Everything depends on the microbes in the soil on this planet. So it's, you know, having that outlook to start with, your practices should focus on, again, is carbon into this system and how much carbon you can leave for those microorganisms to process. You need to leave at least 40 to 50% of that carbon in that field. That's what we're seeing when we look at, you've done the adaptive multi-paddock grazing from what I read about you, and you know there's a certain amount of biomass that needs to be put on that soil and allow the organisms to break it down and start recycling those nutrients. And that feeds the roots, that feeds the plants, and feeds the microbes as well. It's kind of like the energy necessary to keep that system going.
Yeah. Bison and the buffalo built that 40 feet of topsoil in the Midwest, and they did it because of predators chasing them around and keeping them grouped up so they would eat one area and then move on and let it regrow and not come back to it for a while.
Keeping them in tight herds as well. So that hoof action could actually push that organic matter onto the top of the soil to feed those microorganisms. Now, all of it was, that whole system, quite elegant and quite impressive what it did to North America, because it spanned from Florida to Alaska and from California to Maine. You know, those bison were everywhere across the North American continent.
Wow. Yeah, I remember seeing the pictures of the farmers moving west and people being going out on hunts from trains and shooting bison out the window of the train as they went by, and the skulls piled up in a pile 15 feet high just kind of as, oh, hey, we got rid of these darn bison.
Yeah, that really worked out well for us.
Yeah.
Now we understand that importance, though. Sometimes we do some dumb things, but it comes back and hits us in the back of the head and wakes us up and say, oh, my gosh, you know, what we had, can we get it back? And how can we get it back? And we see we can do that, you know, with the multi-paddock grazing or what we're calling a biologically enhanced agricultural management, where a lot of the energy in the plant matter that we grow stays in that system to feed those microbes.
So you've done a lot of actual profitability numbers and have demonstrated that that you can farm without nitrogen fertilizer, that there's a learning curve for the soil. The soil has to move away from being dependent on chemical inputs and develop its biodiversity and its richness. But after doing that, that is a profit-making system. Can you talk some about that? And how do we get that adopted? How do we turn this on so that we're actually influencing climate change?
Spreading across really big growers, obviously industrial ag, which is responsible for a lot of the pesticides and fertilizers that are limiting that carbon capture. Are you finding some open minds in the wider world to make this spread over many thousands of square miles of agriculture here in the United States?
Well, we are opening some minds. Of course, you have to have the data to do that. And we were fortunate enough to get a project with Stella McCartney on cotton farming in Turkey. She sources cotton fiber and fabric from an organization in Turkey, from Soktis. And we got a project there looking at how can we help reduce the carbon footprint of their farming system at that point. And we were coming in, we showed them how to make the compost. And the compost is different from other compost. It's allowed to mature for a year.
Mm.
So it's a very different substrate that you're putting in there. It's a very diverse microbial community, fungal dominant, as far as the mass in it, and it's put on at about 2.2 kilograms per hectare or 2 pounds per acre rate. It's injected as an extract into the furrow when we planted both cover crops and on the cotton crop, which is the dirtiest crop on the planet as far as herbicides, pesticides, fertilizers. So we had a challenge there in Turkey. But normally, for the last 2 years, cotton farming, your profit margins are from minus $11 per acre to minus $137 per acre.
Very profitable.
Very profitable.
Wow.
Yeah. Now, we were able to turn that around in Turkey with this. They were able to reduce their nitrogen inputs by 85%. So we just 15% of the rate of normal nitrogen application. And we reduced their input costs from, they normally had 22 trips across the field for herbicide, insecticide applications, fertilizer applications.
And all that's damaging the fungi in the soil, all that tramping around with the tractors.
Oh, yes. And we reduced it down to 4 trips across the field. Just for planting, they had to go in with one insecticide application, but they reduced the insecticide application by 56%.
Now, mind you, this project is like an island in the midst of the conventional cotton farming with all the pesticides, herbicides around, and able to reduce the pesticide input and totally eliminate herbicide input, that is just remarkable in our eyes.
We implemented cover crops as well into the system, and we would inject the compost into the furrow at planting of those as well. So just productivity-wise on that cover crop, we went from 400 grams the first year for that winter cover crop to 692 grams of dry biomass per square meter the second, 925 grams the third year. So we doubled the productivity or the productive capacity of that soil over that three-year period. We also saw the reduction of herbicide, 100%, 56% for insecticide, 61% for diesel, 85% for synthetic nitrogen fertilizer, and 100% for phosphorus. We reduced their input cost $470 per hectare per year. And water, we're able to reduce by a third. They normally get three waterings from the government, and this one of the years in there, they had to cut down to only two, so they did not damage their crop productivity. So that automatically makes them more profit, makes them where they can make a profit. And that doesn't even start to consider if they were paid for the carbon that they captured. They were capturing carbon at an average rate of 6.59 tons of carbon per hectare per year.
So put that carbon capture in perspective to driving cars or, you know, something that people can relate to besides numbers.
Well, I give you a normal rate for carbon accrual in soils that they're seeing. The possibility is 0.5 tons. We're doing 6.59 metric tons, which is about 13 times what other researchers have seen in their research. So it's when you bring the whole system back functioning and having the cover crops, having that system in there that all components are working, you get this fantastic increase in growth capability. So you're getting that translates into the reduction of carbon out of the atmosphere. And that's significant. Now, there's really no issue here on the atmospheric carbon reduction. We can do this in farmland very easily once we pull this back into these systems. And farmers will become more profitable. They can use smaller tractors, which will compact the soil less. They'll use less fuel, less fertilizers. You won't have that the downstream effect of all the fertilizers, because most of them just get leached out of the soil and go either into the aquifer below or into the rivers where the excess water flows.
And this goes back to Todd's question here. How do we convince larger acreage farmers? And in this case, the farmers, they actually expanded the operation beyond the scope of our 5 hectare of research. And how much do they have now?
Well, they have 2,000 hectares in Romania, and they've increased 10 times the cotton production under bean in Turkey.
Yes.
Wow.
And to us is that not until we are able to provide a path forward that is relatively comfortable for the farmers to try it, then, you know, it will be hard to convince them. But with the numbers like this, with the farmers, they're happy about seeing the biodiversity on their farm return that they have not seen since they were children. They were excited about the worm count went from 0 to 100 per square meter, and the birds came back and other things came back. So it's pretty exciting for them to see that. And on top of that, it's the profit margin. If they cannot make a living, they won't transition. And so this is the part where we try to convince people that you can do something that meet your bottom line and become a fantastic steward of your land in the same time.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah, we've seen some farmers in Montana. Corey Miller, he did. He was just doing a test of it on one of his plots. He had a cereal rye that he's planting. And he only did one pass with the biology just to see what would happen. And where he didn't have the inoculant, the cereal rye was about 6 to 8 inches high.
where he had the inoculant, it was 4.5 feet high.
Whoa.
Whoa. So
it was pretty graphic. What, when you get the right biology into the soil, what it can do when it's working with the plant. And Jay Young is also in corn in Kansas, I believe. He's also used it. So we get a lot of different people. It's, I think we've seen it in about 70 different countries across the planet. And what we've seen on Google as far as the interest in it. So, you know, farmers, they're smart. You know, they're very cautious because everybody has something to sell. But this is open source. It's free to them. It's something they can do. We have a farmer in Ukraine. He couldn't get fertilizer, and he couldn't get to his inoculant for his chickpeas. And so he said, well, he had like how many bioreactors? 100?
Over 100.
He had over 100 bioreactors that he built over there. And he used it on his chickpeas. He had the best chickpea crop he's had in years. Without
so bioreactor, a bioreactor is one of these composters that you people have developed that allows you to make make something to apply to the crops and the soil.
Yeah, it's just a static composting process. We make it on a pallet. It takes approximately a year. You keep it 70% moisture content, irrigate it daily for about a minute. Don't let it freeze and don't let it dry out. Then it will, the bioreactor is about 4 foot diameter, 5 foot high. You start with about 2,000 pounds of material. You end up with about 700 pounds of finished material, and that'll do about 350 acres of land. So it,
Jim Stiles here in Vermont has been following your work and determined to figure out how to do mini bioreactors for small-scale properties. And he presented that at the recent NOFA conference here in Vermont. And I will put a link up to his work for people on our website so you can
send that to us.
Yeah. And also Steve Shivers and Carrie Noble in Iowa, they've been doing some fantastic work as well. So we're just so grateful for all these people. They have the passion and they don't mind do hard work and they just wanted to help others. And that is part of this movement. It's sort of kind of grassroots. You put it out there and allow those innovative, smart, hardworking people to take advantage of the free information. And they do that on their own farm, on their own time, and utilize it, and it becomes part of their tools in their toolbox. And most importantly is that most of these people, they understand the fact that this is not magic. This is something they work into their ecosystem, their agro-ecosystem, and they all understand the concept of it's inoculant. The Johnson Soup bioreactor, that compost that came out is full of microbes and full of organisms that to help them. And it's more of, it's like an incubator for very diverse microbes to help them kickstart. And once they get going, that they need to have roots on the ground, underground all the time, living roots. So you are having that carbon cycle that's actually functional carbon cycle, not just something that dead, that you bury carbon in the soil. So it's just really exciting about all these people we have the privilege to know and meet.
Yes. Wow.
Yeah, definitely picking up on the excitement. Quick question. Are you finding, you know, you mentioned that these practices may being taking place in 70 different countries, and it's certainly a sort of a DIY grassroots sharing information among farmers. Are there any government, you know, ag departments of any world governments that are saying, you know what, we need to learn more about this and promote this? Or is this strictly all sort of like the mycelium of small farmers spreading the word about the bioreactors?
You might say it's grassroots.
Yeah, definitely. Okay.
No, no governments don't seem to get it yet.
Okay, that's what I thought.
I think it's agenda driven.
Okay.
As well.
Yep.
I won't say anything past that.
No, you don't need to, Henry.
Yeah, but you have come up with your research with statistically significant results. In other words, you've done it scientifically enough to be able to have published papers that are recognized as, hey, this really happened. And so it's not just farmers talking to farmers about, well, I got pretty good results, and look at that strip where I applied that. And, you know, it's out of that and into, yes, you can take this to the bank. How do we capitalize on that that statistical work that you've done?
Yeah, it's necessary to have both the grassroots and also have scientific studies on it as well. And we were fortunate enough in that project in Turkey that we were able to get enough data that we were able to get a paper submitted and approved for publication. It's in the Peer J right now, and it should be out in about 3 weeks. We need the scientific data as well in order to, well, try to convince governments that this is the right path forward, either state or national or international governments. You have to have the data for adoption.
Yeah, and typically for government to adopt anything, they always come back to, where is the data? That's the bottleneck. And we are just so happy, and having data, research takes money. Just the lab analysis alone, it takes a great deal of money to analyze. And so it's not just the researchers doing the work part, but it's sending into the lab to get them analyzed, because a lot of this just takes time and effort. And we're fortunate enough to have Globetrotter Foundation with No Regret Initiative to support us on a lot of the analysis and other verification research beyond just research project. And so we're very fortunate, and we're very privileged in the same time that we are able to get the data to support what the farmers are seeing. So now they can arm with verification and the redemption in the way of that this is not just me thinking, this is not just me imagining things. Actually, this is proven that what I'm doing is valid. And we're very happy about that, because there's so many of them. They're so courageously doing work to feed all of us, and even in the hardest situation. And we definitely are not farmers here. We research. But, you know, we need to give them as much support as we can.
And keep in mind, we only had one trip to Turkey to get these farmers up to speed.
Wow.
And these guys took it and ran, because it's been 5 years now. And we've seen those increases year after year after year consistently. And also the nitrogen in their soil. They're increasing nitrogen at 607 pounds per acre rate in their soils per year.
Per year. Wow.
Without inputs.
Again, D.D. Purcell's figure that I love quoting is that when photosynthesis takes place, 40% of that carbon and nitrogen that is produced by the photosynthesis is given back to the soil. So it isn't just growing the plant, it's growing the soil at the same time when photosynthesis happens.
Yeah, we're learning slow, but it's possible. You know, before, you know, looking at half a ton of carbon per hectare per year was just, no, that's not going to hit it. It's not going to get it done. But at this rate of, you know, 6.5 tons of carbon per hectare per year, there's a lot of things that can be fixed here, a lot of problems. You know, whatever your agenda, you know, it can take care of atmospheric CO2 problems. It can take care of the leaching of nutrients into our water supply, or the toxins from the pesticides and herbicides.
there's so many benefits from this, and the farmers are more profitable. And this is a bad time for farmers. There's a lot of farmers going out of business right
yes.
now because of the way they're farming, because of the way the pricing is. And the possibilities here to bring back our agroecosystems is phenomenal.
Well, it's exciting, and I thank you both so much for the work you've done and are doing, and for coming on GreenZine and spreading the word, because I think we need to shake people by the shoulders and make their heads rattle to see if we can get this adopted.
Yeah.
Climate solution.
Yeah. Well, we appreciate the opportunity to share this as well, and we're hoping the farmers can stop and maybe consider maybe there's a different way. You know, it's a tough thing, but we're not here to sell you anything, so that should make it a little easier. But it's a process that they can learn, and then they can have something to pass on to their children as well.
Well, great information. And we're glad to spread it to our grassroots listeners here in Vermont, and we appreciate you checking in from New Mexico. Really great material and great data that we're going to save. It's not going to be scrubbed by the government.
Thank you very much.
Todd.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Henry.
It's all up on our website in the notes, all the different references to your work that I have so far. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Have a good day.
We will. Okay, Henry, excellent job. We got 3 minutes left in the show. Hey, just while on the subject of farming and data, and we know there's a lot of lawsuits going on from the grassroots from various organizations about some decisions being made down in Washington. Dateline here from the New York Times from Karen Zrake. Organic farmers and environmental groups sued the Ag Department this past Monday over its scrubbing of references to climate change from its website. The department had ordered staff to take down pages focused on climate change on January 30th, according to the suit, which was filed in the U.S. District Court of Southern District of New York. Within hours, that information started disappearing. That included websites containing data sets, interactive tools, and funding information that farmers and researchers relied on for planning and adaptation projects, according to the lawsuit. So that certainly is in line of some of the work that our guests were trying to combat, not with much help from the federal government. I'm going to turn it back to you in just a minute, Henry, but I do want to give people a heads up. Next week, we are hoping to have Adam Koslowski as our guest. He's giving a presentation for the Tunbridge Conservation Commission on March the 7th, next Friday. And the topic of his discussion will be understanding bats through their ecology. And it is part of the winter evening series that the TCC is putting on. And you can find out more from us next week when we talk with Adam, or check out today's Herald on page A8. Back to you, Henry. We've got just over a minute to go.
Yeah, and I'm a low-income person without a whole lot of... I got flexibility, but I haven't got much money. And this whole legal pushback that's happening against what's going on in Washington, I sat down with my checkbook and started writing checks to any legal fund that I thought needed some support for taking the actions they're doing to push back.
Wow.
I don't think that's an only job, but it got me doing things I don't normally do.
Well, don't go bankrupt on us, Henry, but I appreciate your generosity.
I hope I can continue to have cell phone service.
Yeah, well, thanks everybody for listening. The show will be up on our replay function starting tomorrow morning, and we do have a rebroadcast. We want to thank the folks that helped keep GreenZine on the air: White River Land Collaborative, Wit and Grit, First Branch Coffee Company, Solar Fest, Upper Pass Beer Company, Solaflect, Bale, Royal Trail Works, and Daniel Leibowitz. Stay tuned for Democracy Now! At WFVR-LP South Royalton. See you next week, Henry.
Have a good week.